use of the hands in playing the scandala are that the right hand plays a melody line in chords, and the fingers of the left hand damp or stop the strings that have already been played. The left hand can also be used to play bass chords or other embellishments, but because this instrument doesn't have a damper, it's basically up to the left hand to stop the strings. If you notice that when I play a string, the sound lasts a long time, so these notes have to be stopped when their time is up. The next song that I'm going to play is a short little tune, the very impressive title of Konivits and Kirkon Kello Jansoitto. Can you get that? It's the translation or the title means that in this particular town, the church bells are ringing. It does. Most of the Finnish people that maintained the traditions of folk song singing and kantele playing were people from what once was Eastern Finland or Karelia. It's now part of Russia. There's a song from this area that I like, which is the lyrics to the song are about a peddler who travels on foot from village to village and farm to farm selling his wares. And the song expresses his loneliness and homesickness for his own home and family, the song of the peddler.
This part's got to be sweet.
Oh, I see.
The kantelas in use today in Finland are shaped a little bit differently than this one. They have a more rounded shape, and they usually have 32 or 36 strings. There was a man in the 30s and, well, 20s and 30s, I guess, who made some changes to the kantele, which made it a more versatile instrument. This man was named Paul Salminen. One of the things he did was to put a damper on a hinge that you could damp all of the strings of the instrument with just a very quick motion of the left arm. You also put a lever on a particular tuning peg so that you could, for instance, change very quickly from a B to a B flat. He also had some master switches by which you could change all octaves of Bs to B flats. So this made the instrument more versatile, and music is still being composed for the kantele. It's still played today in Finland, although there aren't many players, even in Finland. But the music is quite lovely. There are some very good recordings. So if you happen to be in Helsinki next weekend or something, pick up a record or two. It'll sound very different from this kantele, but I can assure you it'll be quite lovely. Well now, let's see, you've heard the history of beginnings of kantele from its invention or creation by Väinämöinen, the folk hero, up through modern times. But some of you might be wondering, well, whatever happened to good old Väinämöinen? Well, when Väinämöinen realized that his time was up, or that his function was through, he sang magically for a last time. He sang up a copper boat, a copper-decked vessel. He sat in the stern and head out for the clear expanse of the sea, toward the upper reaches of the earth, toward the lower reaches of the heavens. And there, out of weariness, he stopped with his craft. But he left the kantele behind, the fine instrument for Finland, the eternal source of joyous music for his people, the great songs for his children. Well, I too know that my time is now up, well, just for today anyway. And so my kantele will sing magically one last time. Last song I'll play is composed in recent years by a kantele player called Greta Haapasalo. The title of the song is Minun kanteleeni kaunamin, and the lyrics express the thought that my kantele will sound even more sweetly in heaven than it does here on earth. And you know, sometimes I think that the only way I'm going to get into heaven is only because I play the kantele. Minun kanteleeni. Oops, almost forgot. Thank you. enjoyed it, and thank you. Want to give me a hand carrying stuff back?
I have a note here that Miss White from Seton School should go to the administration tent to pick up Michael Tonic, a lost child. Thank you.
One, two, three. Can you hear me?
Woof, woof. Woof.
Good afternoon. I'm glad to be here and present our folk life for our folk life festival. A little higher. Okay. Go ahead.
I got. That's my job. See.
Okay, you introduce me.
My job to introduce you. From Embarrass, Minnesota, and it's spelled the way it sounds. And it's a French term. The French got driven out by the Finns many, many years ago. So, I'd like to introduce a man who practices the traditional crafts in a traditional way and is very particular to make sure that all of the methods that he uses are accurate and are traditional, and he frowns upon the use of nails and glue and things like that, and does everything by hand.
You remember the glue.
I remember the glue, yeah. Mr. Marvin Salo.
Good afternoon. I'm proud to be here as a member of the Folklife Festival and bring some of our Finnish tradition from northern Minnesota down to Washington, D.C. And as you probably know, our tradition in northern Minnesota has stayed in northern Minnesota for the reason that even the fourth generation still speak, are bilingual. They speak Finnish and English both. A lot of songs that you probably have heard here are Finnish songs, and you probably have heard a few English songs around, not too many of them. But to hold tradition into the area, and the way it was taught by the ancestors, would have to relate back to your, to the original language it was taught in. So I believe that a lot of these methods will be lost if we don't try and teach them or translate this into the English language so the rest of the people can enjoy this too. So under this method, I have been trying to give a survival kit for our crafts and our traditions. And so I go back into the where I was raised. I was raised in northern Minnesota, what they call it's a poor area. Everything we had to make, or our mode of travel in the wintertime was skis, and in the summertime, our mode of travel was a pair of good feet with hard soles on them that you developed when you started out in the spring and jumped around like a rabbit because you stepped on the first rock, and by the fall time, they're so tough you could step on nails. And this goes back into why I think that most people survived, because they just had to be tough to make it. Now, under this craftsmanship, what crafts I do, as this was taught to me by my great uncle. My great uncle says, in Finn, he said, Nutsina opit. And that was the beginning of it. He said, now you learn. This is it. This is it. You're not going to get away from me now. And if you didn't learn, he meant that you will decease. You won't have a chance in life. He came from Lapland, which is upper part of, he roamed, I should say, the upper part of Norway, Finland, Sweden, and Russia. And a lot of these methods you probably will see that I use in my crafts pertain to not only the Finnish people. It's to the Scandinavian people, which is Russia, Finland, Norway, and Sweden. It'd be the, and even there's some, I think there's some of this that pertains to Estonia. Estonia, I think the skis that I make is the bottom has been developed from Estonia. The Estonian have a flat bottom, and the groove comes up and is straight across and down again, which makes it a lot easier. If you have a line that goes like this and you stretch it out, it has more friction. But if you bring a straight line up, straight line over, straight line down, straight line back, for the bottom of the ski, which would be a square bottom, this one would have less friction. Consequently, you wouldn't get as tired per mile as you would if you had a round curved bottom on your ski. So I think this is Estonia. This comes from Estonia. I have a, well, it could come from Finland, Norway, but Swedish have the round groove in the bottom of their ski. Now, if there is any questions, raise your hand, holler, and say, wow. Is there anything you'd like to have me add to that? Yes? The groove is, I don't have a ski here, and I don't have an easel here. But as, oh, I can do that. We'll improvise. Give me a, can I use a piece of paper? Just a small piece of paper. I don't need very big. Now, the top of the ski naturally would be straight. You know, you put a straight top. Let's put a mold like this on a ski. The top of the ski would be straight. The groove in the bottom of the ski would come. The groove in the bottom of the ski would be pertained about this manner. As you look off, if the ski was cut in half, it'd be in this manner. But if you take this piece of the same length of paper and you make it round for the same length, it'd be quite a bit longer. So consequently, it'd have more friction in it. But as you cut the sides down and your sides up in this manner, it would have less friction, and naturally you wouldn't be as tired. You wouldn't wear out as fast, because skiing is a method of motivation, and motivation is a method of travel, and the travel is a long distance. And you never go any further than you knew how to get back from. Now, is there any questions? Where is this? There's a young guy here that wanted to know some questions. I guess, yes. Yes, that's why they have the straight groove. That's why they, most all Finnish that were racing skiers up in northern Minnesota had the square groove on it, and then the method that they use for speed, they use the concoction of pine tar, bear grease, paraffin, and this made a base, and they put it on their skis, which enabled them to walk up a hill and slide down a hill. And this would change in all different types of snow. And any other things? Okay, then we'll go into the next phase of it. We talked about skiing. Now, to have a good ski trail, you had to find a way of making it. So naturally, they developed the system of snowshoeing. We didn't. The Indians did, I think. But being that they were these Finnish people, their mode of travel was by foot, and the best way they knew how. So you'd cut a trail into your trapping area with a pair of snowshoes, and that same distance you could cover in less half the time than what you could on original pair of snowshoes. And during this time that you'd be on your trapping run or trapping or traveling from, you always try to keep the trail open so you had a good trail to ski on. Then you could make it real fast. In other words, it would average, I don't know, I would say it used to take us 12 minutes to go to school, and that was 2.5 miles. So I don't know if that's any record-breaking, but there's a lot of downhill on there and just a small amount of uphill. and it used to take us 14 minutes to get home. And we like to be home in 14 minutes because my mother usually had a hot cup of coffee and maybe some fresh bread or some of this finished pancake they're making there. And that was our beginning of our day for that evening. And then we'd have to go out and clean the barn, milk the cows, and then go back into your method of what you were doing. If you had time in the evening, you'd run out and set your traps or check your traps and then come home. And maybe you'd have to churn butter or clean butter or whatever it happens to be. You'd have to do that then in the evening. And our system out there was, there wasn't too much money changed. It was mostly bartering. In our neighborhood, we had a blacksmith. We had a butcher. There's a horse trainer. There was a man that was pretty well in taking care of cows, who was a veterinarian, type of veterinarian. He finally, the health department of the state of Minnesota took that man into court for practicing veterinarian without a license, because he never was. He was no more than just about a midwife would be nowadays, but I guess midwives have to be licensed now too, I think. So this, the area is, and the most of the people that wound up in the backwoods or up in the bush, as they call it, would be caused by the mining companies in 1916 had a big strike, and there's so many people got blackballed from the mines, which were indentured people from Finland and Yugoslavia and quite a few of them that were indentured into this country. And then the strike came on, and they were blackballed from the mines. They couldn't get back in the mines. Well, then they went into the woods, and this is the way they made their living. And a lot of them then moved in after that. They moved into the area, and they started developing their farms, and they bought land or homesteaded land and started their farming. And this area still has a lot of log cabins on it. It has some new homesteads. In the last 20 years, I think it's gotten a lot of homesteads in it. But a lot of tradition that we have is still there. The folklore and the tradition is there. And the children, yes? Not very many. No, most of them, they took and they homesteaded. There was a new country, it was a new land, and they homesteaded. And they found out that homesteading, they could make with all the different people that were in their... See, it's a bit heavy Finnish area, and each of these men had a different craft, were apprenticed in Finland. And these people, they would take and by pooling their sources and their resources, they could survive. Like February 24th in our folklore is Matinpäivä. Matinpäivä. M-A-T-T. Matthew's Day. And this is February 24th, and this is the time that an average family would take and check their food larder. And this food larder at that time had to have 2/3 for the person to survive for the winter, and 1/3 for the livestock of their total food larder that they put up for the winter. And if they didn't have this, consequently, they didn't have a chance to make it. So the next Sunday, you would go to church, and that was most likely by horse and buggy or sled or whatever it happened to be. I don't ever remember going on Matthew's Day to church with my parents, only by sled and horses. And at this time, then the people in the neighborhood, they would get together and they would talk about, little boys talk about little girls talk about little boys, and they'd have their potluck dinners. Everybody went to church carrying a pot of some type. They had a potluck dinner, services in the morning, services in the afternoon, potluck dinner, and the men talked about their food, if they had enough food to sustain their life for this time. And then if somebody had a new brand of oats or somebody had cows for sale, this was the place that it was, a lot of transaction was taken in the local churches. And like our church in Pike River, there has been my wife's grandfather owned a sawmill, a shingle mill, and a grist mill. And it was all run by steam. And so... this way, they would know if he was able to take logs to the sawmill. Like, say, Monday morning, I got a bunch of logs I want sawed. Well, Sunday, instead of walking all that distance to find out, they would meet at the church, and at the church they would say, do you think you could take my logs next week someday and saw some lumber? I need some 2x4s or something. So then they would saw it, and he'd say if he could or if he couldn't. Anything else? This is up in northern Minnesota, Embarrass, Minnesota. It's on the Iron Range. It's in the Arrowhead country. And then most of the people, like myself, I wasn't too much in that country then. My uncle did run a logging camp, which would be in Skibo area. And that was Pickren, and their name was. And they run a logging camp. So I wasn't too much up in there, but I was up in a little bit west of there in western Minnesota, and where I was reared part of the time and part of the time up on the range, which was changed. Okay, and then now to go back to the traditional method of making things, you'd always use, as you worked in the woods, you'd always find things that you needed. So you acted as a pack rat, and you hauled everything home that you could possibly think you could use. Like the birch bark you'd pick at a certain season, just to make a birch bark pack basket, and this, or a basket or something to carry your food. And this was used like carrying your stuff, a hot dish to church with. And if you put a, like they used to do, they used to take and use, they call it sammali. It's a moss that you pull out of the swamp, and they take this sammali and they bring this out and they dry it. And they'd wrap this up into a towel. You know, put two towels and put this moss in between there. Then they'd wrap their hot roast or a pot or whatever they had, and they'd put it in this birch bark basket, and they'd bring it into, which birch bark is a very good insulator, in a sense. And then they'd bring this hot dish to church. So this was the most modern method for birch bark, to get a hot pot in it. And what else? Anybody else got any good questions on that part of it? Don't you have anything, Larry?
How about birch bark baking utensils?
Yes. By the way, you know, they used to make, at Easter time, they used to make a bread, and it was baked on birch bark. I don't remember the name of the bread.
I don't know about bread, but there's mamia, kind of like a
yeah.
That was baked in birch bark.
Yeah. And then there's another thing. Like if you'd be out in the bush and you'd be working a trap line or something like that, and you needed hot water for your drink, or if you're up at the lake and you were going to have boiled fish, fish is boiled good in there, in birch bark. You take and you make a pan out of birch bark, and you keep that wet, and as far as the water is, the birch bark won't burn. But soon as the water goes out of birch bark, poof, it's gone. But you got to put the brown side towards the flame. And you can boil water in birch bark. It's very simple. Oh, yes, birch sap, you use sugar. I think you've seen these, I think they call them velamins. I think you've seen velamins. That is birch sugar. Those are made out of birch sugar. The sugar is imported from Finland today.
Some of them used to drink their sap to drink when they were working in the woods.
Yes, and they made a beer out of it, which got you very intoxicated, too. Yes, there's a tea that comes out of birch. You take the... Right below the birch bark, there's a brown layer, and they used to make amitta mihen juontisitte. You'd take this stuff and you'd crumble it up into small pieces, and then you'd boil it in hot water, let it boil, and your water would turn kind of reddish color. It's a little bit on the sweet side, and it's a little bit on the bitter side, but it isn't very... It'll work as a kind of a... I don't know what you call it, but it's, you can get by with it. It's better than water. Pardon? Yes, the leaves are used as sauna switches. Oh, yes, the sauna. There's a part that we got to get into. The sauna switch, the birch trees used everything out of that. I don't care what it is. It's being used. The root is being used to make utensils because it's a snarly root. And this will hold regardless how you take and make a utensil out of it. It won't crack, twist, or anything. You can carve a root out and make a dish out of it. The leaves are used as sauna switches. They make a sauna switch out of them. Which, I don't know if you, how many people have been in sauna? You use a sauna switch and you stimulate your skin to perspire. And as you perspire, you loosen up what they call, how would I translate this now? You loosen up your small blood vessels on the top and stimulate them so the circulation in your body would arise due with the heat. And this would consequently make you feel good and fresh and, you know, kind of, well, in other words, after you got us out of sauna, you could take and run 12 miles and go back in and take another one. All right, now then we'll go to the different types of snowshoes. Now this snowshoe here that I'm talking about, that we talked about snowshoeing, this one here is known as a pack shoe. The reason it's a pack shoe, it's short, and you'd ski your trail in the wintertime with skis. Let's go to the beginning. This one here would be a traveling shoe. You would travel and probably break your trail out first with this one. Then you'd go skiing. You'd ski that same trail to keep the trail open while you're trapping. Then you would go to the small pack shoe and just carry it on your back because it's light, it's short, and it fits in your pack. And if you wanted, or you seen something that was had a little life in it in the area, you'd take your pack shoe out, park your skis on the tree, walk off with your pack shoe, then come back and pick up your skis again and then finish your trail. Or if you seen something that, you know, that was interesting. And very seldom you'd use this pack shoe to cross a river. You'd always use the longest and the biggest flotation shoe that you could find. Beaver trapping, you always use the large shoe. This size shoe, you'd use at beaver time. And the reason it would be it had more flotation than the smaller ones did. And if you did go through ice, it very seldom you did, if you watch yourself, if you listen. But this is the type of shoe you'd use for beaver trapping. So there's a trapper, a swamp stomper, a traveler, and a trapper. Is there any questions on that?
You never break trail with your skis then? You like to do cross country?
Oh, yeah, you can break trail with it, but it gets awful, awful hard. Especially if you're going to travel any distance at all. I always preferred to make a trail and try to keep that same trail open with a pair of snowshoes and then follow it with skis.
How often do you go over the trail that you need to keep it open?
Well, if you're trapping, you go every day. You'd at least go four times a week for sure, if not five. Maybe Sunday you didn't go was about the only day. Anything else? Pardon? No, it fills in. It fills in, and then after it fills in, you can just about tell where it's at, but you won't sink down only about the distance of the snow. So you'll have, by springtime when it starts thawing, it don't pay to travel on it because you have a trail 4 feet high sometimes be a foot, and if you tried to travel on it, it was solid ice or it was a solid trail, and then there you'd slide right off and you'd be up to your, higher than that. The first pair here is made out of black ash, and it's got cowhide woven in there as a webbing. It's called spar varnish and boiled linseed oil. This pair is made out. This one here is made out of birch and rawhide. This has never had any finishes on it. It's just the same thing as, I left it natural as it was. This one here is made out of black ash and cowhide. And this I made one Sunday morning. The frame, I made these one Sunday morning. I was walking in the woods and I happened to see a nice tree, so I cut it down and I brought it home and I split it just to make it as a pair of snowshoes out of it. But there's one thing, this bend will not stay in this shoe unless you do it the right way. You bend this green, this has all been bent green, and as you bend it green, I throw it on top of the wood pile and I wait for it to thunder and lightning and rain on it. These frames were made in the springtime during the sap is running, and the wood is real pliable. And then it has the thunder and lightning and rain on it before the bend will stay. Otherwise, the bend will fall out. Now, according to... That was our folklore. It had to do this before you'd have a good pair of snowshoes. Everybody talked about, boy, my snowshoes are on the wood pile. Well, mine are too, you know. What kind of frames did you get this year? And the other guy said, well, I got this kind of frame. But then Ethan Allen saturates their wood. I'm not advertising Ethan Allen, but I happened to talk to a craftsman that worked at Ethan Allen, and he said they saturate their wood with nitrogen, and then they put it into a mold and they bend it. And consequently, this nitrogen must have a certain amount of, chemistry in it to hold the bend in the shoe. And the same thing, they've been doing this for years. The Eskimos and the Upper Michigan people have been doing this for years, the same method to hold a bend. If you find a shoe that doesn't, the bend does not stay on, it probably didn't thunder and lightning on it when it was drying out. I have a pair at home that's made in 1932. The end of the shoe, the end where this rivet is here, it's a, let's say around, right about here. The snow has wore that shoe down, so this rivet, end of this rivet is right in here. Oh, I try to keep one pair always going every year for the simple reason that you never know when you need another pair. Yeah, I got 21 pair. No, I don't. I don't sell any of these crafts, and the reason I don't because I like to take and give this craft for people that want to learn it, that they would learn it instead. If I start and sell you a stove, you would never make a stove, would you? So if I tell you how to make a stove, that tradition would be carried over. So this is why I do what I do it the way I am. Now, in the last year, we started writing a book on this method of making snowshoes. And, excuse me. But the problem run into there, I didn't know how to spell. So I put it all on tape. And then I had a friend of mine, which is a very good writer, and we got together and we put this book together. And his name is Hugh Bishop, and he did a very beautiful job of getting it together. We were trying to get some copies of the book to sell here for people that wanted to buy it, but due to the reason beyond our control, we didn't have enough money. We run short on money to begin with. And another thing we did is we didn't have it quite all in completed. And we had to get a few other things straightened out in it, which was we needed research on it because we didn't want to step on anybody's toes while we were doing this writing. So this is the part that took a lot of effort and a lot of time to do it. And so now when we get back, it'll be about the latter part of this month, it'll be on the market for sale. We finally finished our research and our program. So there is a book if you have any young children or people that are trappers or hunters or woodsmen. I think it has a lot of information for them in the way of that we were taught as children as the survival. I have quit that altogether. I have another job myself. And I don't need that for survival, so I'm leaving that for some people that need survival, so I don't trap anymore.
What do they trap?
Well, now there's quite a few pet trapping, and, you know, it's a normal fur-bearing animal, but I have quit that completely because the reason is I got another job. When I need that place, you know, if I need that, I will go back into it. If it comes to the part that where I'm going to have to make a living again, other than the job I have, I will go. I can return to it.
Is it always easier to use snowshoes than skis, or just when you break the ground?
It depends on what you're doing. I would say that if you want, like now, for many people that want to jog and exercise, And especially if you want to get a good hard stomach muscles, which I don't have. If you get a good pair of snowshoes, you can sure make out on them. And a lot of this, a friend of ours, and she was having what they call trouble with her feet. And she was walking with her toes protruded out. And she started snowshoeing and skiing. And consequently, now when she got married, her toes are just as straight forward as can be due to the exercise of snowshoeing and cross-country skiing. If you don't hold them right, you don't go. Okay. Now, the strange part about this, you see these little pair of snowshoes I got on me? That snowshoe has the same weave as this one. So does this one. You can count the sides on it. It should have five on each side. It's got exactly the same weave. And the reason that I did this, I developed this weave so even a person that is just wants to start making snowshoes or wants to get into the craft, it's very, very simple. It isn't a difficult weave, and you can weave it by the numbers. And so this took quite a time to get it so it would come out nice and, you know, square off the way it should be and look as a snowshoe. Now, this snowshoe was bent, long piece of wood, and it was bent while it was green. To get the wood to bend from the inside, you take the material out from the inside so it'll bend. Don't ever cut the material on the outside of the wood. You always take the material from the inside of the wood out to make the bend, regardless what bend. If you make this bend, you take the material from the inside of here to make this bend. There's a notch cut in here. There's a notch cut in there. There's one on this side and one on this side. And that puts your cross pieces in. This one here has got aluminum rivets in it with a steel washer. Well, I didn't know of any other method. I want to keep them light. I could have used a wooden dowel. And the wooden dowel is, the method of doing that is you